KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The Supreme Court says the Trump administration cannot deport a group of Venezuelan migrants held in Texas, at least for now. We have the latest. Also in this hour, reaction to RFK Jr.'s controversial remarks on autism and advice for the HHS secretary.
He can work with our community, but it requires listening to us about our own lives and what we actually need.
Plus, it's Easter Sunday, and many churchgoers will be dressed in their finest. We talk about the evolution of the biggest day in church fashion. It's Sunday, April 20th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen says the Trump administration is thumbing its nose at the Constitution. The Supreme Court has ordered that it facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, who was illegally deported to a Salvadoran prison. Van Hollen had met with Abrego Garcia in El Salvador last week. He told NPR he must be returned.
If you can deny one person their constitutional rights, that is a threat to the constitutional rights of everybody who lives in the United States of America. So that's the bottom line. They need to obey the court orders and bring him home so he can have due process.
Van Hollen also said the U.S. is paying El Salvador to keep the prisoners. He said he doesn't think Americans want their tax money spent in defiance of constitutional rights. Tens of thousands of people rallied across the country yesterday to protest a wide variety of President Trump's recent actions. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports from a demonstration at the state capitol in Juneau.
It's not the first time 500 people have braved cold, rain, and wind to protest Trump here in Juneau, and organizer Megan Lingle says it won't be the last.
We are going to keep showing up until they listen to us.
She held a sign saying, "Bring Kilmer home." That's a reference to the man the Trump administration deported to El Salvador in what government lawyers called an administrative error. Another organizer, Aaron Brakel, says Alaska is suffering from cuts by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency effort. Alaska receives more federal funding per resident than any other state.
We're in a lot of trouble in this state because of Donald Trump's policies.
Federal cuts have hit fishing, forestry, and weather forecasting especially hard here in Alaska. For NPR News, I'm Eric Stone in Juneau.
Pope Francis had a brief meeting with Vice President J.D. Vance this morning in his residence inside Vatican City. Megan Williams reports.
The Vatican says Pope Francis met privately with Vance on Easter morning to exchange holiday greetings. The brief encounter came a day after Vance held more formal talks with senior Vatican officials. Francis, still recovering from pneumonia, did not attend those meetings. Vance, a Catholic convert, has publicly clashed with the Pope over immigration. Francis has called President Donald Trump's crackdown a, quote, disgrace, and indirectly rebuked Vance for using Christian values to justify hardline immigration policies. The Pope called the immigration policy a, quote, major crisis for the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Megan Williams at the Vatican.
As he is still recovering, the 88-year-old Pope did not celebrate Easter Mass today, but did appear in St. Peter's Square in his Popemobile. Drawing cheers and applause, he stopped occasionally to bless babies brought up to him. This is NPR News in Washington. The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for large swaths of Oklahoma, as well as parts of Texas, Missouri, Arkansas, and southern Illinois today. Oklahoma was hit by severe weather yesterday. Police say a woman and a boy died when their car was caught in floodwaters. The capsule carrying NASA's oldest serving astronaut and two Russian cosmonauts landed in Kazakhstan early today. They'd completed a seven-month mission aboard the International Space Station. The BBC's Orlando Teal has more.
Standing by for touchdown and touchdown.
The landing in the remote steppe area of Kazakhstan took place on schedule in the early morning. The three men were carried one by one out of the capsule and given time to adjust to gravity before being whisked away by helicopter. The American astronaut, John Pettit, who is celebrating his 70th birthday, looked disorientated as he was carried out, but there was no indication of any major problem. One of the Russian cosmonaut's first move, as he returned to Earth, was to peel and eat an Easter egg handed to him by one of the crew.
The BBC's Orlando Teal. In case you missed it, Juno won Scotland's Corgi Derby yesterday. The Corgi was the favorite breed of the late Queen Elizabeth II. The race was first held in 2022 to mark her 70 years on the throne. This year, 16 dogs competed, all dressed in bright sweaters. Juno came from behind in the final stretch to win the trophy and dog treats. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The Supreme Court moved swiftly and in the middle of the night to stop the deportation of a group of Venezuelans being held in Texas. That was in response to an appeal by the American Civil Liberties Union. Later yesterday, the Trump administration filed paperwork asking the court to reconsider, saying the case had been brought by, quote, radical activists. We'll turn now to Stephen Vladek. He teaches law at Georgetown University and writes a newsletter about the Supreme Court called One First. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Aisha. Great to be with you.
So what was notable about the court's order, the speed, the early morning decision?
Both of those things. I mean, I think, Aisha, the things had developed very, very quickly on Friday, where you had a group of, as you say, Venezuelan migrants who are being held in the northern district of Texas, so basically sort of up in the panhandle, where they had received information that the government was considering removing them from the country pretty quickly under the statute, the Alien Enemy Act, that the Supreme Court had just 2 weeks ago said the Trump administration could use only if it provided notice and only if it provided these immigrants with a chance to challenge their removal in advance. It looked like that wasn't going to happen, which is why we saw the ACLU move so quickly on Friday and why we saw this extraordinary late-night intervention from the Supreme Court.
Do you sense that the court is frustrated with the White House?
Yes. So I think what's striking about Friday night's ruling is that, you know, in the earlier decision back on April 7th, the court had actually given the Trump administration a bit of a small win by saying that the cases challenging removals under the Alien Enemy Act had to be brought where individual detainees were held and not in the Washington, D.C. Federal District Court. But, you know, Aisha, those cases have now been brought, and we've now had judges in the Southern District of Texas and a judge in Colorado and a judge in New York all say, hey, you can't remove these folks until they get the due process the Supreme Court has required. I think the Supreme Court was quite frustrated with the sense that the Trump administration was appearing to flout the mandate that these folks receive meaningful review before they're removed.
Several conservative justices voted against the president by pausing these deportations. Did you expect that?
So, I mean, yes and no, Aisha. So, you know, the key, I think, to me is that we had two justices who had voted, or I guess three justices who had voted back on April 7th to require these cases to be brought in Texas and elsewhere, who nevertheless voted to block the removals Friday night. So Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Neil Gorsuch, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. You know, Aisha, I think to your prior question, insofar as these three justices were concerned that the Trump administration is, you know, thumbing its nose at the court, or at least playing Calvin ball, where it just keeps changing the rules as it goes, I think Friday night's order was meant to send a bit of a message like, hey, stop. Like when we said we want these immigrants to receive due process before we remove them, we meant it.
Do you foresee a showdown on this issue between the executive and the judicial branches of government? And what specifically would happen, right, if the White House does not adhere to these orders?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question, Ayesha, is how much can the White House afford to alienate those three justices in Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh? Because it's not just, you know, this case where they're depending upon the Supreme Court. They're also currently at the Supreme Court asking for permission to fire members of the National Labor Relations Board and the Merit Systems Protection Board. So, you know, I think there's a showdown looming. I think the question is the Trump administration going to keep trying to play these kinds of linguistic and interpretive games where it says, oh, well, this order only applied to the Northern District of Texas, not the Western District of Texas. And if so, do we see increasingly aggressive responses from the Supreme Court along the lines we saw late Friday night, responses that maybe the Trump administration ultimately has no choice but to comply with?
Well, I guess that's the question. Do you see this court stepping up its efforts to rein in the president and maybe rein in some executive power, which has been growing even before Trump, but Trump has kind of kicked it up to a notch?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Ayesha, the verdict is still out on that. I think the one thing we can say about all of the movement we've seen in the Supreme Court in the last couple of weeks is that the justices had been trying to move somewhat gingerly and had been trying to temporize their rulings by not giving Trump everything he asked for, but also not just reflexively ruling against him. What Friday night's ruling, I think, really drives home is that the court was not impressed with the Trump administration's behavior after the April 7th ruling in the Alien Enemy Act case, that the court thought it needed to send a stronger message to the Trump administration. Whether that translates, Ayesha, in other contexts and into other cases remains to be seen, but at least for now, it's a hopeful sign that the Supreme Court's not just going to roll over and let the Trump administration do whatever it wants.
That's Stephen Vladeck of Georgetown Law. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. calls the rising rates of autism diagnoses in the U.S. an epidemic. And last week, he pledged new research looking into environmental factors that he believes lead to autism. Many researchers are challenging the scope and focus of the new initiatives, and many people living with autism are condemning these remarks from Kennedy.
These are kids who will never pay taxes, they'll never hold a job, they'll never play baseball, they'll never write a poem, they'll never go out on a date.
Colin Killick is the executive director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and he joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So RFK Jr. went on to say that autism destroys families. What's your reaction to what he said?
Disgust and fear, frankly. I mean, I'm autistic, and I have done many of those things. And, like, I have quite low support needs, but I know autistic people who do all those things, including autistic people who have high support needs, who are non-speaking, who have intellectual disabilities, right? Secondly, the idea that someone who's incapable of doing those things, or who needs supports, that their life has been destroyed and their family has been destroyed is just awful and not true. Like, the fact that he would say that about our community is just pretty appalling. And we're really concerned at what policies are going to come out of a Department of Health and Human Services when its leader espouses these kinds of views.
You are a poet, as well as the executive director of your organization. How important is poetry to you in expressing, you know, your feelings, your thoughts? Do you speak about these sorts of things through your poetry?
Absolutely, yes. I have been doing disability rights activism since 2013. I have been writing and performing poetry since 2012, and those two things have very much gone together in my life. I do slam poetry, performance poetry, and a lot of it is about disability rights, my experiences as a disabled person, as an autistic person. And it has been really, you know, important for me both to sort of better understand myself and be able to communicate my personal experience. One of the first performance poems I ever wrote was explaining my motor dysfunction issues. I wanted a more fun for me way of explaining that my hands didn't work in the normal way. But also, it has been a real tool for me to be able to educate other people.
for parents of children who may be autistic, or they may be concerned that their child may be autistic, they're going to have a harder life, and they feel like maybe there is some sort of, I don't want to say cure, but there's some sort of way they could avoid it, or there's some sort of way, and that would help their children have a, in their view, a better life. And they feel like RFK Jr. is speaking to their concerns, or speaking to their needs. Like, I guess, what do you say to them?
You know, life as an autistic person is difficult. You know, most of us have some things that we struggle with, but also a lot of it is, life as an autistic person is difficult because we live in an ableist society, and because supports and accommodations and services aren't readily available. And so I think what we would say is, we do need a government that is cares about autism, that is investing in autism. But the thing to do is invest in the kinds of research, the kinds of services that actually help autistic people. And I mean, the biggest thing here is, right, is they're trying to cut Medicaid, right? And, you know, hundreds of thousands of autistic people rely directly on Medicaid for services and supports. And it's going to be an awful lot more difficult to get, especially because those kinds of waiver services are optional for states to provide, and thus are likely to be the first ones on the chopping block.
So if you did have a chance to speak with RFK Jr., what would you share?
I think I would just share that, you know, we aren't a plague or a cataclysm, is I think another word that he used, right? And that, like, autistic people's lives can be difficult, but they are, can also be joyful, right? And, you know, in our entire community, across the entire spectrum of levels of support need or types of impairment, that our lives are worthwhile and worth living, and that we do contribute to society. And that I would say, you know, he has an enormous amount of power to shape the U.S. health agenda, an enormous amount of money at his disposal. If he cares about autism, and I believe that he cares about autism, even as horribly off base as he is in how he approaches it, if he focused on policies that would improve the lives of the autistic community, and above all, if he listened to autistic people, if he would listen to autistic people when we tell him what we actually need, he would have a chance to do a lot of good for our community instead of spreading pseudoscience, instead of giving families false hope. And he can work with our community, but it requires listening to us about our own lives and what we actually need.
That's Colin Killick, Executive Director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia continues to attack his country despite Russian President Vladimir Putin's unilateral declaration of an Easter ceasefire. Russia says Ukraine launched hundreds of attacks overnight. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel has no choice but to continue fighting Hamas in Gaza. The war will continue until Hamas is destroyed, the hostages are returned, and the territory is no longer a threat. And a Soyuz space capsule landed in Kazakhstan this morning, carrying two cosmonauts and a NASA astronaut. They had spent 7 months on the International Space Station. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at MacFound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Outnumbered and outgunned, that's the status of the police force and United Nations-backed peacekeeping mission in Haiti as the transitional government there struggles against a coalition of gangs. Those gangs have already conquered most of the capital, Port-au-Prince, and the government has announced a war budget to bolster the fight. To tell us more about the situation on the ground, we turn to Harold Isaac. He's an independent journalist in Port-au-Prince. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So help us get up to speed on what's happening around you. How much of the city has fallen to gangs?
Well, right now it's estimated that about 85% of the capital is now under gang control. People are really restricted to just one part of town, which is Pétionville. And to get supplies, such as whatever comes by boat, they cut through gangland and they likely pay to get through. For the most part, the about a million displaced people are running a cat and mouse game with the gangs.
What is in this war budget that is being talked about? Could it make a difference?
The most significant aspect of that war budget is the signal the Haitian government is sending towards mainly the army, because the army had been disbanded back in 1994. And as such, the army ever since remained, you know, either inexistent or a stub, right? Today, with that new war budget, the operative budget of the Haitian army, it will benefit from a boost of around $275 million, which is unheard of, really, in our history. But whether or not this will materialize in real life and how remains to be seen.
There were Kenyan police deployed in Haiti in 2024 as part of a UN peacekeeping mission. What's the latest on their efforts to fight the gangs?
Essentially, the mission was set to have, at least to start off, about 2,500 members. That has yet to materialize. At best, you know, the mission was about 1,000 members so far, mostly from Kenya and some members from the CARICOM community. But it hasn't delivered big wins just yet.
The Trump administration has sought to end the temporary legal status that allows thousands of Haitians who have fled the country to stay in the U.S. Last week, a judge halted that effort. But if it were to succeed, what would mass deportations from the U.S. look like, especially now in the midst of all of this fighting?
It's unclear. And the reason it's unclear is because we are in uncharted territory. The international airport of Port-au-Prince is closed. So what would likely happen is this influx of people would go to the second city of Haiti, which is ill-equipped. So Cape Haitian is totally overwhelmed with all the surge from Port-au-Prince. And they would likely be greeting this influx of people that be returning.
The Miami Herald reports that the State Department is going to designate gangs in Haiti as foreign terrorists. What impact might that have?
It certainly sent shockwaves in Port-au-Prince. There are people that are really concerned that this may discredit the country furthermore. And there are other people who are saying this is great because there is no infrastructure to harbor the gang members who have essentially last year destroyed many prisons, including the main one with 4,000 prisoners. So having them being potentially sent to Salvador, and it's creating a dynamic that we had not foreseen yet. So it's a very complicated situation, and it just added an extra layer to it.
If the transitional government were to fall, what would that mean for you personally?
I'm personally exposed. You know, like, gangs are around the corner virtually and literally. They're pressing really, really hard. We're in an unforeseen situation. There could be a total collapse of the legitimate governance here in Haiti, as the situation remains very, very complicated and fragile.
That's Harold Isaac, independent journalist in Port-au-Prince. Thank you so much, and please stay safe.
Thanks for having me.
Later today on All Things Considered, a trip to Hungary for a look at how the leader there is systematically chipping away at democratic norms. It matters because other autocrats are noting Viktor Orban's methods, which include attacking core elements of civil society like judges and journalists. He's forced many newspapers to close and chilled the landscape for others.
Nobody was brave enough to print in Hungary, so we have to find a printing company outside from the country. Until now, our newspaper is printed in Slovakia, in Bratislava, so we have to organize every week transportation of the newspaper.
Lessons from Budapest later today. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Nonprofits across the country that rely on federal grants are seeing that support evaporate as the Trump administration aggressively cuts government spending. And now even groups that don't take federal money are facing growing uncertainty. Natalie Skoland reports from Denver.
What's the little guy in? See?
On a sunny spring day, 71-year-old Armando Guardiola sits by an open window in his ranch-style home in Metro Denver. Guardiola loves to take walks outside or help with chores around the house, but that's become a lot harder lately. For the last 3 years, he's had to spend hours each week at a kidney dialysis clinic, and severe joint pain makes it hard to walk. This pain saddens me, he says, but I don't want to give up hope just because it's gotten worse. A few times a month, Guardiola drives over to the local community center to see some friends. A local nonprofit called Conectores de Montbello connects Spanish-speaking older people to each other for companionship and connects them to resources like mental health services and boxes of fresh produce. It started with about 100 participants. Nearly a decade later, that's grown to almost 500. But now, with uncertainty around funding for diversity initiatives both locally and nationally, and recent sweeping cuts to health programs under President Donald Trump, Conectores leaders wonder about their future. Conectores doesn't receive any federal funding. Its money comes from local and national philanthropic foundations. And those foundations are being asked for a lot more help since President Trump was elected.
A lot of people, I think, are figuring out how to make up holes in their budget or are needing money sooner or quicker than they may otherwise.
That's Lorez Meinhold with the Caring for Denver Foundation, which helps fund Conectores. The program relies on multiple non-government funders, and leaders say some grants come and go from year to year, and strings attached often require lean budgets. Sydney Beyer is with the National Aging Foundation Next 50, which gave Conectores a grant that expired last year.
There's not enough funders to support the needs of older adults. Definitely more folks are reaching out saying the type of funding that they may need to fill a hole that could be, lack of government funding.
Conectores leaders are currently in conversation with Next 50 about future funding, but no promises have been made.
Caras! La Palma!
For now, the nonprofit is continuing activities to boost local seniors' mental and physical health, like playing the Mexican game Loteria.
El Venado!
Loteria!
Guardiola's got a knack for Loteria, but he says win or lose, all of this, being together and having some fun, gives him reason enough to get out of bed each day. We all see each other as family, Guardiola says. For now, staff here have taken salary cuts rather than scaling back their work, hopeful that more funding will come through in the future. The need will continue to grow as Colorado has one of the fastest growing populations, age 65 and older. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Skoland in Denver.
Universal's Epic Universe opens next month in Orlando, the area's first major theme park in 26 years. It took an estimated $7 billion in 8 years to build. And with it, Universal, which we should note is a financial supporter of NPR, hopes to become a more formidable competitor to the dominant player in town, Disney. Brooks Barnes is a reporter for the New York Times, where he's covered Universal's latest big play in the theme park industry. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
So why is Universal betting big on a new theme park?
Universal, since 1990, when they came into Orlando, has been in the shadow of Disney. They've been lucky to get sort of spillover. You go to Disney, maybe you go to Universal for a day out of, you know, your week-long trip if you're a family that loves theme parks. Universal wants to flip that relationship completely. They want families to primarily visit them and then go to Disney for, you know, 1 or 2 days. That probably isn't going to happen, but that's the goal.
Well, so you say it's probably not going to happen, but can this new park, if not unseat Disney, as is the goal, can it at least make Disney nervous?
Yes, it can absolutely make Disney nervous, and it is. When you talk to Disney, they tend to look at Universal very dismissively, to be candid. But Universal, they're watching Universal very carefully with Epic, in part because the initial responses have been pretty amazing, and I think that has really gotten Disney's attention. It's certainly gotten the attention of Wall Street, which is paying attention to the dynamic and whether Disney loses visitors to Universal.
Well, let's get into what's in the park and what you saw. Like, what are some of the Epic Universe's big draws?
There are five worlds, if you will, lands, and each one of them is just 100% immersive into whatever theme it's talking about. There's one about Super Mario Brothers. There's one about Universal Monsters, Frankenstein, Dracula, Harry Potter Gets a Land, and How to Train Your Dragon.
And so when you say immersive, like, what do you mean? Like, what is it, just that everything is like, you know, if you're in Super Mario Land, there are a bunch of pipes and mushrooms? Or is it like, what is it that makes it so immersive?
Yes, there are pipes and mushrooms and piranha plants and coins that are spinning. But the way that it's built, you really can't see out of the area where you are. It's like you're inside a game completely. And because it's built from the ground up, you know, using all the technology they have now, it's very interactive. So in that Super Nintendo world, for example, you can download the Universal app and then compete with games throughout the land, and then also have that score continue onto the ride, and you can compete against your family, other strangers, people in other Universal parks. And that's something that, you know, younger theme park goers really want. Mm.
So as you said, you visited the park for its soft opening and spent a couple of days there. What's your verdict?
I've been doing this a long time, and I was pretty blown away by the care and thought that Universal's put in this. Disney often, because it's so big, gets all the attention, you know, for advancements on ride systems or, you know, theming of certain products. But Universal in recent years has really taken a lot of the lead there. Some of these rides, they use ride systems that Universal has developed and patented and that we really haven't seen before.
So just how important are theme parks for these giant corporations with tons of IP, like, you know, like Comcast and Disney? How important are they to the bottom line?
Theme parks are getting so much attention from investors and these companies because they're the part that's the most stable in recent years and the part that's growing the most. And that's why we're seeing, you know, billions and billions of dollars being poured into these properties. The challenge, of course, is that you don't really know what kind of market you'll launch into. Universal is now sort of opening this massively expensive park into a very unstable economy. You know, will people worried about rising costs cut back on vacations? Maybe.
That's Brooks Barnes of the New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Lamb of God comes from the Gospel of John. It's what associates Jesus with lambs and what's behind so much of the symbolism of Easter. This time of year is also lambing season. So we take you now from metaphor to literal lambs. NPR's Brian Mann has been spending time on a shepherd's farm in far northern New York.
It's pitch dark, cold enough we can see our breath in our headlamps when Kristen Kimball leads me inside her barn.
It's about 5:30. The sun is thinking about coming up. Oh, look, we have triplets.
Kristen wades through a sea of sheep, their long faces eager and curious. Her light picks out a ewe with three tiny newborns.
Come on. There you go. You ready?
There's a reason I'm here. I was having dinner with Kristen and her husband Mark here on their farm. We've been close friends for years. I told them I was feeling sort of blah, and Kristen said I have just the thing. You have to spend time with baby lambs.
So now I just want to make sure that she has milk and that all the babies are doing okay. So let's see, we have a girl and a boy.
They are super healthy. I kneel next to Kristen in the bed of fresh hay and the lambs. Picture long-legged, clumsy poodles crawl up over my knees.
These look like nice, strong babies. They're going to be just fine.
It's been a bountiful season so far. Kristen says she hopes for up to 400 babies before this is done. The only complication is it's been cold here in New York Champlain Valley, not far from the Canadian border. One night I spend with Kristen and her flock, it's snowing.
It was 19 the other morning, and they were born and just popped right up and started nursing, which is what you want.
Being here is such a joy, despite the cold and dark. I keep coming back. I sit in the hay with the big, shaggy shepherd dog while sheep nuzzle around us. You'd think pregnant sheep would be skittish, but Kristen says this is when they're most cuddly.
Like this ewe, for example, she's full of hormones. She's got oxytocin coursing through her system. She's in a mood to be around other creatures and just like give love.
The birthing doesn't always go smoothly. One afternoon when I'm in the barn, a ewe has a breech delivery.
So we're gonna need to flip the baby around and pull it out.
Kristen calls over a farmhand who helps hold the animal tight while Kristen reaches a practiced hand inside.
I feel a back, but no legs. So now I'm gonna try to find which legs go with this lamb.
With her cheek pressed against the lamb's flank, Kristen straightens the first lamb.
I see a hoof.
All right, now we're gonna go quick.
Three tiny lambs pop out, one after the other, wet and floppy.
She's licking the lamb off, which dries the lamb. Really important when it's cold. And they're bonding.
Kristen grins. I sit cross-legged next to her in the hay that smells of summer. I'm just grateful to be here. Soon I'm covered again in wriggling lambs, eager for warmth and touch.
They're the best.
I'm surrounded. I'm literally just being kind of covered in little... Yes.
I can see Kristen is weary. Lambing is hard and messy, but she also looks happy. There's joy in this season, in this work, and in all this new life. Brian Mann, NPR News in Essex, New York.
This is NPR News.
Influencers are urging people to place their orders at online bargain stores like Shein as prices go up.
Y'all better go ahead and get y'all Shein carts out the way now.
What's prompting their advice? And the Disney Plus Star Wars spinoff Andor returns.
The Empire cannot win. You'll never feel right unless you're doing what you can to stop them.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. More flooding is expected again today in Oklahoma, where two people died in floods yesterday. A flood watch is also posted for parts of Texas, Missouri, Arkansas, and Illinois. Senator Chris Van Hollen says the Trump administration must comply with the Supreme Court and facilitate the return of Kilmo Abrego Garcia, who was illegally deported to a Salvadoran prison. He says denying one person's constitutional rights is a threat to everyone. And on this Easter Sunday, Pope Francis appeared in St. Peter's Square in his open Popemobile to wave to the delighted crowd. He did not celebrate Easter Mass as he continues to recover from pneumonia. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from Subaru, in partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. This weekend marks the 250th anniversary of the Massachusetts battles that sparked the Revolutionary War. In the towns of Lexington and Concord, there were parades, historical reenactments, and, as you'll hear, the echoes of the revolutionary gunfire of April 19, 1775. Member station WBUR's Steph Brown was there.
It's a crisp early morning. The sun hasn't peaked out just yet, and the air is filled with anticipation.
The regulars are on the road!
Dr. Samuel Prescott races over Concord's North Bridge on horseback, screaming a warning to the crowd that the British soldiers, the regulars, are coming. A troop of Minutemen, New England's militia, march closely behind. Like the man playing Prescott, they're all reenactors. They gather at the top of the hill and fire a salute. The reenactors and thousands of onlookers came to Concord to honor a bit of history. 250 years ago, on April 19th, 1775, the British marched to this site to seize weapons and squash the possibility of rebellion. But colonial militias, the Minutemen, descended on the regulars, forcing them to retreat to Boston and attacking them as they fled. The events here and at nearby Lexington proved that the militias could stand up to the British as the American War of Independence began. Brush Bradley marched in the parade in Concord as a militiaman. He's holding an 18th century musket and looks every bit the part.
This is an outfit that my wife made that represents the militia from the 1776 timeframe.
For Bradley, this day is about commemorating and honoring his ancestors who supported the American Revolution.
People came to the colonies for religious freedom. They came for new opportunities, and America represented an opportunity for them to make their way and make their fortune.
Families traveled from across the country to celebrate. Some came for the parades, some came for the politics, and some came for the love of history. Like young Tyler Boyle from Martha's Vineyard, who is here during school vacation week.
I like history and the American Revolution.
Can you tell me what happened on this day in 1775?
Well, the Redcoats marched into Lexington and battled the Lexington Minutemen, and then they marched to Concord.
Xander Kessler lives in Colorado but grew up in Concord. He's in town to run the Boston Marathon Monday, and he woke up early to get here. Because for him, the battles here have urgent parallels to today's political struggles.
You know, sort of the whole idea that the Concord militia was out here in 1775 is that we didn't want a king then, and you know, the people who live in Concord in 2025 still don't want one.
The day ended with speeches from politicians, real ones, not reenactors. Massachusetts Congresswoman Lori Trahan is among them. She said that those who fought here left a long legacy.
Every generation inherits the promise made here in Concord. And every generation must choose what echoes we will send forward.
And it was that spirit that got Andrew Johnson to come from Maine to watch and to consider what he called the American experiment.
This is not the first moment of tumult that I would say that the country has faced. And I would say that's part of the experiment. And so from that standpoint, you can always have a lot of hope.
Andrew said he's looking forward to seeing what comes next. For NPR News, I'm Steph Brown in Concord.
In the new novel, Fair Play, two things can be true. Abigail can be hosting a New Year's Eve murder mystery dinner party at an Airbnb.
In this envelope, you will find a character card, which gives you information that no one else knows. You will see that there are specific instructions, but you should...
Abigail can also be in deep mourning for Benjamin, her only sibling.
Our sincere condolences to Abigail on the tragic and sudden passing of your dear brother.
Fair Play is the debut novel of Irish author Louise Hegarty. It honors the golden age of crime novels just as it turns the genre on its head. She joins us now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So when we first meet Abigail, I mean, it seems like a setup for like this typical murder mystery. And I've kind of gotten into cozy murder mysteries now. I like them. You know, you have the usual elements. It's a country house, a gathering of friends and associates and, you know, someone who you don't know very well. Can you tell us more about how your novel begins?
So it begins, they have gathered together at a country house to ring in the new year, but they're also there to celebrate their friend Benjamin's birthday. His sister Abigail has devised a murder mystery game that they all play. The next morning, everyone wakes except for Benjamin.
And then you have this great detective who shows up, August Bell. How would you describe his contributions to the story and the plot of the story?
Yeah, so August Bell, we first meet him in part two of the book, and he kind of suddenly springs up out of nowhere. And he's very much in that vein of like a Hercule Poirot type of detective. And he's there to facilitate Abigail. She's trying to uncover the clues around her brother's death. And it's also about providing her with kind of a comforting pathway through that and a comforting narrative that she's familiar with because she's a big fan of detective novels.
So much of the way August Bell talks is like he's very blunt about this is the way murder mysteries work. These are the rules. And then he also goes on page 23. I said this. I'm not going to get to this to chapter 22. Like it's meta, right? Like what made you decide to put together the book in that way and to wink at the audience that way?
The idea of having a detective in a murder mystery who is aware that he is a detective in a murder mystery novel, and he's aware of the tropes of the genre, and it's all kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge at the reader. It's a playful take on a murder mystery and using that structure to look at the emotions around grief and around sudden death. I suppose I was thinking a lot about those original Golden Age detective novels. I mean, that period between the wars where people were coming out of the First World War, dealing with a huge amount of trauma, who were grieving and looking for familiar narratives as a comfort. And so ultimately, that is what Abigail is doing.
It's a lot going on because you have like the murder mystery of like, who killed Abigail's brother, Benjamin. And then you also have the mystery of like Abigail's brain, like the story that she's telling herself. I wanted you to read this part where she's thinking about her last Christmas with her brother, which is just a few days before his death.
Benjamin came over to my house on Christmas Eve and left on Stephen's Day. We had breakfast on Christmas Day morning and unwrapped presents. We went for a walk before lunch. During the meal, we took a call from our aunt. It was a normal Christmas. Benjamin was in a good mood.
And then over the next like few pages, Abigail keeps repeating and then striking through and repeating and adding details and subtracting details. And she's replaying it over and over in her mind, trying to make sense of it. Where did you get this idea from? Has this happened to you?
You know, well, I think we've probably all lost somebody and we've all grieved. And it is that kind of normal thing that you do, that you look back at the last time you saw them or kind of recent visits with them, and you start examining everything that they did. Suddenly becomes a very important thing. You start looking for clues as to what was going on for them or what was happening. Abigail, she's kind of stuck in examining this last Christmas with her brother in minute detail, hoping that she'll remember something where everything that happened after that will suddenly make sense.
Yeah, it's interesting because murder mysteries, you're often not dealing with the grief of the murder or the pain of the murder. It's just like it's a puzzle to be solved. This book kind of forces you to deal with that other hard part.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a big fan of those detective novels myself. And the characters in them, you know, people are dropping dead all around them and they don't really seem that pushed. You know, there's not a huge amount of grieving for people who died. And from the reader's point as well, like, I'm never that upset when someone dies in a murder mystery because that's the point of them.
Yeah.
And I mean, there is that kind of puzzle to be solved. And they're a form of escapism as well.
It makes me wonder, like, are fair play mysteries kind of like the horror stories that I like, a way to consider mortality in a safe way and a fun way, because there are rules like you can't have supernatural happenings. It can't just be an accident.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think death is kind of the one thing. I mean, we will never figure out that mystery. And as people, what we do is assign narratives and stories to our lives in order to make sense of them. I think the idea of trying to make sense of death is such a large part of human existence.
That's Louise Hegarty. Her debut novel is Fair Play. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hallelujah. It's Easter Sunday. And Hollis Booker, like many churchgoers, has been planning a special outfit for today.
I will wear my best suit. I will have my shoes shine. My son, he would definitely have a sports jacket on and be dressed different than any other time.
The retired minister remembers always trying to dress to impress on Easter Sunday. Booker lives in Aurora, Colorado, but comes from a family of sharecroppers in rural Tennessee.
As sharecroppers, we didn't have a lot of means, but what we did have, we made sure that clothes that we were going to wear were pressed and clean and shoes well shined and ready. It's a matter of presenting yourself before God as we saw it and letting the Lord know that we are looking for something better in the year to come. And that tradition, it was carried over from slavery. Sundays was the only day that slaves were given off. And that day was a special day because they would worship. And then at that point, still they would be clean, make sure their clothes were clean, especially on Easter.
Dressing oneself in adornment and glory and praise to God is honoring the divinity in you and the body that God made.
Taylor Crumpton is a writer and journalist who writes about music and culture. The 29-year-old lives in Chicago but grew up in Dallas, Texas, where Resurrection Week culminated in what she calls the Olympics of church fashion.
Easter Sunday is the Sunday that many church congregations look forward to. And for Black women and girls, this is their time to shine. The first thing that comes to mind and the first thing that will capture the eye is a hat, a purple hat, a green hat. The more color, the better. The girls will be in their baby doll dresses and a shade that complements the mother's outfit with a matching headband. What a shiny shoe. And you can't forget It is a full family affair. Everybody is coordinated to the nines. Every accessory has to be new and matching.
The hats, if you could talk a little bit more about the hats, because it's really those church mothers. And these hats, they're crowns, really.
A crown is a fitting term. It really ties to a historical tradition of, you know, adornment of the head from the Great Migration and also from the Harlem Renaissance. When we see these church mothers in their hats, they're colorful, they're dressed in silks and sparkling with rhinestones and flower garlands, feathers, lace, all of this adornment to catch God's eye.
Did fashion play a role in the church that you grew up in?
I grew up going to Corinth Missionary Baptist Church, which is my father's church, which is his mother's church. And my granny, whenever I would spend summers with my grandmother and we would go to vacation Bible school, I would put on her gold bedazzled bracelets because she wasn't able to. I would make sure that she had her gold cross, that her hat looked nice, that her wig was laid. And I just remember seeing my grandmother still at the age of over 90, trust me enough to help her prepare for the ritual that is church dress and church fashion. You know, the late American fashion designer Patrick Kelly said that in one pew at Sunday Church in Vicksburg, Mississippi, there's more fashion to be seen than on a Paris runway. There has always been a relationship between fashion, the Black church, and where we are today.
Well, yeah, and I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, reports show, you know, fewer young people are attending church these days. How can a tradition like this, you know, getting super dressed up on Easter and that particular Black Easter fashion, how can that live on?
Well, we've always adorned ourselves. In many West African rituals, there are elaborate adorned headdresses. In Sunday rituals in the Caribbean, there has always been a understanding of Sunday being a days of putting on your best. So regardless of whether young people are going to church, intrinsically embedded within us, there is a universal cultural sentiment that even if I'm not in the church house, I can give glory to the Creator for the spring season. And 9 times out of 10, we do it with our clothing.
That's Taylor Crumpton. She is a writer and journalist. She lives in Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Happy Easter to all who celebrate. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.